Let me quickly say a couple of words about our today's speaker, Ravit Golan-Duncan. She is currently an associate professor of science education at the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers University. She started her education at university level at Hebrew University at Jerusalem with a bachelor's in biology or biological science. She went on in biological science with her master's degree from the University of Illinois at Chicago. I could try to tell you about the title of her thesis. It was about the analysis of the clathrin assembly properties of UNC11 isoforms and mutant proteins. So hope I pronounced that more or less correctly. But then she went to Northwestern University for her PhD in the learning sciences with a dissertation title that was Reasoning in Molecular Genetics from a Cognitive Model to Instructional Design. That might sound familiar, more familiar to several of you, with committee members Brian Reiser, Daniel Edelson, and Bruce Sharon, who are quite well known in our community. So, so Ravit will explain us a little bit more also about that uncoordinated war. But may I invite you, Ravit, to tell us a bit more about your own perspective on your progression through the sciences, through biology and the learning sciences with, the target being the learning progression in the end. So what led you to do research on the learning progression?
Hi, everyone. Great to be here. I hope everybody can hear me okay and that you have my slides. So my slides have a little bit of animation on them, and they also have slide numbers on every slide except the first one. So as I'm going to go through the slides, I'll just say change slide or click, and then you can click and hopefully you'll be able to see the animation at the same time that I'm sort of trying it on my computer. So as Frank said, I did my master's in biology on worms. These were C. elegans little worms, and they were uncoordinated and they had a particular mutation, and I studied that. Before that, I actually got my bachelor's in biology from Hebrew University in Israel, so I'm Israeli. And as I did that, I realized that while I love biology, I was just not really cut out for bench work. I liked learning about it, but I did not really like doing experiments. And so I started looking into education, and I spoke to someone at Hebrew U about starting a program in education. And what they said is that I would be better off if I had a master's degree in the field, in some content expertise. So I did that. I got a master's degree in the field, and I did that in Chicago, at the University of Illinois in Chicago. That's where I studied the worms. And after that, I was looking, you know, to figure out how to move on to a PhD program. And I didn't really apply broadly. I wanted to stay in Chicago. I applied to Northwestern thinking, well, if I get in, I'll go to Northwestern. And if I don't get in, I'm going to go back home to Israel and figure out something there. And as you can guess, I got into Northwestern, and I started working with Brian Reiser. And initially, I was sort of really interested in everything. I came in thinking I would study genetics, and then within 6 months, I was just interested in everything. Anything that I read was like, oh, I might want to do that. Oh, this is so exciting. And so basically, after a while, a couple of years of doing all sorts of things, I started doing genetics work. And the work that I'm doing now, and that I will show you in the presentation, that's essentially work that grew out of my PhD. So if you could go to the presentation and click on the next slide, we've got a little overview. So I told you a little bit about how I got here. I will say a little more in a second about why learning progressions. I'll talk a little bit about what learning progressions are, a little bit about my work in genetics with a learning progression, and then some challenges, and then we'll have some sort of activity that I've prepared that hopefully will work out for us. It's all part of the slides. So let me just see if I can get my slides to project. No, I can't. Okay. So moving on to the next slide, slide 3, I sort of talked about that. This is me and where I came from. And when I did my PhD in genetics, I developed a theoretical model of how kids reason about molecular genetics. And one of the things that I noticed is that we kind of tend to cram all the stuff they need to know about molecular genetics into the high school. And one of the questions that I sort of ended my PhD with, that I didn't answer as part of my PhD, but I was interested in, was, well, can we start earlier? Is there something we can do maybe in middle school to start bringing in some of these ideas about molecular genetics so that, by the time they get to high school, we can really deepen them and expose them to some newer ideas, more sophisticated ideas? And at the time, I didn't know that, well, one can call that, you know, that's kind of what learning progression research is about. And I started at Rutgers, and there was someone here called Rick Duschel, who I hope you've heard of. And Rick was at the time working on learning progressions. He was part of the Taking Science to School report from the National Research Council here in the U.S. And that report was one of the first times, it wasn't the very first time, but it was one of the first times that learning progression sort of appeared in a policy document in the U.S. And he got me interested in this whole idea of learning progressions. And so I applied to the Spencer Foundation, the National Academies of Education and Spencer Foundation, and I got a grant to study learning progressions in genetics. And at the same time, I also worked with colleagues of mine, Aaron Rogat, who's here, is working for ETS now, and Anat Yarden, who's Israeli at the Weizmann Institute. And together we developed a learning progression, which then got published in 2009. And that was essentially the way I started on the route to learning progression and learning progressions, and it has since expanded. So moving on to the next slide, the only problem is that when I project my slides, I can't see you guys. But hopefully that will be okay. So I'm going to project my slides and work through them, and I'll stop periodically to see what's going on. But if I'm ignoring you, know that it's because when I project my slides, I can't see everyone. All right. So learning progressions are essentially descriptions of development of either expertise or literacy in a domain over time. They really cover, the point of them is that they describe learning over extended periods of time. They're not just about having more of the same, but deepening understanding and deepening how we're thinking about learning and how we're thinking about and how students sort of come to understand a particular idea. And again, they're not repetitions. It's really about deepening. So if we go to the next slide, slide 5, there are 4 characteristics of learning progressions. One is that they're sort of focused on a few core ideas and practices in the domain. And I'm talking about science learning progressions right now. That's sort of what I'm working in. There are also math learning progressions. They're called trajectories. They're a little different. I'm not really going to talk about them that much. we're going to focus mostly on science. So for science learning progressions, they start with a few core ideas and practices. And one of the new things about learning progressions is that they're really trying to intertwine scientific practices like argumentation, like modeling, reasoning with evidence, and content. They begin with sort of a consideration of where the learners are starting. So you define your lower anchor, that's where the kids are now. And then you define your upper anchor, which is where you want those kids to be at the end. You can have a learning progression that spans elementary school, so it's whatever the end anchor, the upper anchor is what you want them to know by the end of elementary. You can have a learning progression that spans the entire K-12 sequence, and you can have learning progressions that end in graduate school. So it doesn't matter where, you always have an lower anchor, which is where you're starting, and an upper anchor, which is where you want to end. And then the meat of the progression is describing the intermediate steps to get you there, to get students from the lower anchor to the upper anchor. And these steps are grounded in research on student learning in the domain. Okay, so these are not just scope and sequence descriptions. They're not just descriptions of you learn this and then you learn this and this, then you learn this, because as an expert, that's the most sensible thing to me. Rather, they're grounded in what we know about how kids learn in this domain. And in some domains, we have a lot of research in terms of what we know about kids learning. In other domains, we have less. So, you know, you do the best you can in terms of working with the research that's out there. Learning progressions are also not something that just is developmentally inevitable. It doesn't just happen. Kids don't just learn these things by themselves the way they would learn to walk or run or crawl. You need instruction. So you need carefully designed instruction to sort of push kids forward along the progression. And we'll get back to this point about instruction because I think it's an interesting one. If we move on to the next slide, I want to introduce an idea that actually comes from Marianne Weiser and Carol Smith's work, an idea of sort of stepping stone ideas. These are ideas that are, one way to talk about them is productive misconceptions. I don't really like the word misconceptions, but these are sort of productive alternative ideas that on the face of them may be wrong, but they are productive steps on the way to developing expertise. So you can think about it, an example in middle school from the work that I do in genetics is thinking about genes as recipes for proteins. There are quite a few biologists and geneticists that would just argue that that's wrong. Genes do a lot more than that. I would argue that that is an incomplete understanding that's productive. No, it doesn't cover everything. It's not cutting edge, but it is productive. If we think about an elementary example, this notion of weight, rather than teaching kids about mass, which is something they have a hard time reasoning about and is on some level meaningless to them, we're going to talk about weight as a property of matter. And again, technically this is wrong, but it's a productive stepping stone towards more sophisticated ideas. So if we move on to slide 7, I don't really want to go through all this. I kind of put the slide in there so that you have it. The idea of learning progressions is not new. There are other ideas that have been there in terms of developmental approaches, particularly in math. But in terms of calling them science learning progressions and using the terms learning progressions sort of more formally, first time it appeared in the Systems for State Assessment, which is an NRC report in 2005. NSF then funded a bunch of, there were several research calls for proposals about learning progressions, and a lot of the researchers that are working in the field at that point received some NSF funding for that. There was a meeting of a group of learning progressions research. I was part of that group that sort of tried to develop some sort of consensus around what those are. And the reading that was that I recommended for today is the culminating report from that group, right? So that's the Corcoran, Moser, and Rogat 2009 report, which I have with me. It looks like so. Okay, and it's pretty neat report, and it sort of includes what we at the time thought about learning progressions. Since then, there's been a JARS special issue that Cindy Mello-Silver and I co-edited. And Elisa Alonso and Amina Gottwals also edited a really terrific book about learning progressions. I will advertise their book as well. It's green. It's really good. It's got a lot of stuff in it. So if you're interested in learning progressions, definitely get this book. It's a really good book. A lot of the papers that are in this book started out from their LEAPS conference in 2009, and I think that the site for the LEAPS conference, it's called LEAPS conference, and I think if you Google this, you'll go to that site, and a lot of the initial papers that are in this book are there. So if you want sort of a free version first, then that would be the place to go. So moving on, in terms of our little history, walkthrough history, there was then the, actually it's more current, the Framework for Science Education in the U.S., which sort of put together the big ideas that they want students to learn in science, and that has driven the next generation science standards, which are the new standards in the U.S. They're currently being adopted by states. They've been adopted by California, Delaware, a bunch of other states. I don't remember all of them. But in terms of the U.S., that is sort of where we're standing in terms of learning progression. So if you move to the next slide, what we're going to do now on slide 8 is we're going to start talking a little bit about my own research, and I'll give you an example of what a learning progression looks like, just so that we can ground it in some real concrete example. But before I do that, can I get a sense of how everyone is doing? So if you go to the vote, you see the little tab at the bottom under the sort of next to the broadcasting button says vote. You can use your emoticons, or actually I'll ask a question. Are you doing okay? Are you following? Are you understanding? Am I going at an okay pace? If yes, then click yes. If no, then click no. If you're not sure, then you can abstain. And if I get a lot of no's, I will slow down. Okay, so it looks like mostly yes. Do we want to do a quick break for questions before I do the example? So let's do another vote. I'm going to clear the votes. So do we want to break for questions or go on and see the example first and then have questions? No questions. All right. Fine. Very well. So we're going to move on. We're going to look at the examples, and then we'll stop again, see how everyone's doing, and see if we have some questions. So we are on slide, where's my thingy here? We are moving on to slide 9. And this is how I sort of started. So I told you that I did my PhD. I was looking at genetics throughout my PhD. I developed a cognitive model of reasoning in molecular genetics, which is in that blue square on the right in 2007. And I was sort of thinking very deeply about what kids know about genetics. And that began to inform what I want students to know at the end. So in thinking about what do I want a high school graduate to know about genetics when they leave school, assuming they're not going to become a scientist, they're not going to become a doctor, they're just going to become a regular person, what should they know? So the cognitive model from my dissertation work provided one angle or one lens to thinking about what I want them to know. There's also other sources that help me define the upper anchor, that help me define the target of what I want kids to know at the end. One was a model of genetics literacy by Stuart Cartier and Passmore, which is shown on the left. And they argue that there's sort of three models in genetics that if you're literate in genetics, you should understand these models and understand the interactions between them. The first model, which is represented by that pedigree, is the idea that genes are passed on and there are patterns of inheritance between genes and traits. Okay, this is the stuff that you might remember, dominant, recessive, and all that good stuff. Then, what happens once you get a gene? That's sort of a second model. So how does that gene actually give you the trait that you have? If you have a gene for the genetic disease, how does that gene actually make you sick? Okay, so that's a sort of a model of what I've been sort of calling the molecular genetics model, because most of the action there happens at the cell level with genes and proteins interacting. And then the third model is meiosis. It's how you get from the genes that your parents have to the genes that you have. So how are genes physically passed on from one generation to the next? And to really understand genetic phenomena, you need to understand all these models and you need to understand how they interact. There is also standards at the time that informed my work in defining the upper anchor. There's the AAAS standards, the National Science Standards at the time, from 1993 and 96. And there was also research out there on what experts thought people should know in genetics. Some of that research was done by Grady Venville, and they essentially identify, they talk to experts and figure out what experts think a regular person should know about genes. So taking together these resources and other literature that I read, it wasn't just me, it was Aaron Rogat and Anat Yarden, and I came up with sort of the upper anchor for the progression. So moving on to the next slide, 10, we identified a set of big ideas, and the criteria for something to be a big idea, it had to be something that were really, ideas that were really important for personal and civic engagement. Again, we weren't trying to generate scientists, we're trying to generate scientifically literate individuals, citizens. So what ideas are important for citizens to understand? We also wanted these ideas to be generative. We want them to be able to use these ideas to reason about other genetic phenomena. And we also wanted these ideas to be accessible. So there might be more sophisticated ways of thinking about genetics, more cutting edge ideas that we didn't really go there. For example, other functions of DNA, functions of RNA in terms of, you know, catalytic RNA and all that stuff. If you know genetics, we did not go there because we did not think that those ideas were really important for genetic literacy. So moving on to the next slide. I'm not going to go through all these ideas. It's just for you to see. We came up with two general questions. How do genes influence how we and other organisms look and function? And how do we vary in how we look and function? And there were eight ideas overall that formed the base for their progression. And if you go to slide 12, which is animated, what you see is sort of like a table. We had the eight big ideas in a column. We had three levels for the progression: upper elementary, middle, and high. And essentially, in all of those levels, we were tackling all three of the models of genetic phenomena, the meiotic model, the inheritance pattern, and the molecular, at some level. So even late elementary kids were getting something from all of these models, some basic version of them. And as we progress forward, if you click, there should be a text box that comes up that talks about what progress means. So progress to us meant three things. One is developing more complete and coherent understandings of each of those three models. Two, integrating those models. And three, reasoning from the micro to the macro level in genetics. So being able to explain why, if you have, you know, a dominant gene, you look the way you do. So what's happening in your cells, in your DNA, that's resulting in the trait that you are able to see. So if we move to the next slide, here what we have is one idea. It's construct B, and it's the idea that genes have information for proteins. So if you go one click, you should be able to get, let me do that here so that I can see what you're seeing. So if you click once, you get a little text box that says students have a theory of kinship, and this is sort of what kids come in with. Kids know, even pretty early on, fifth grade or fourth grade, that, you know, they kids look like their parents. So that was the level one. Genes contain information about physical structures and functions. As we move to level two, which is our sort of middle school level, we're moving from just thinking of genes as having information, so just from genes as being recipes, to being more specific about what is this information for. And at level two, we want them to understand that genes have information for proteins. Genes don't tell you how fast your heart should beat or how tall you should be. Genes are information for proteins. It is the interaction of proteins inside cells and outside of cells that give you your traits. Okay, so proteins is a really important mediating mechanism in genetics. If you click again, what you see is a textbook that appears next to the level three. Level three is about understanding how the code, the genetic code, actually results in a protein. So if in level two I just, you're coming to understand that genes are recipes for proteins, at a level three you're actually learning to read those recipes. You're learning to interpret the genetic code. So if we move to the next slide, I don't know if this is familiar to you, but we have our assessment triangle. This comes out of Knowing What Students Know, another NRC report. And as part of the work on learning progressions, you know, you come up with a theoretical model, and that's great, but now you've got to validate it. Okay, so the theoretical model that we came up with, the eight ideas, the three levels, all that stuff that I just showed you, it's all hypothetical. It's grounded in research, but it's hypothetical. We don't actually know that that's the way it works. So we needed assessment to start thinking about assessing these progressions and validating them. And if you look at the assessment slide, we're starting with cognition. So our theoretical model, our learning progression, is that cognition piece. It is how we think kids develop their understanding in genetics. Then you have observation. So if you click again, get a little text box under observation. Observation is essentially items. What kinds of questions do you need to ask children or adults in order to get information about how they're reasoning so that you can figure out where on the progression these people are. Okay, so that's what observations are, and interpretations are essentially using statistical models to link the observation, so what the student said, to the theoretical model, which is your learning progression. And in the midst of all this, if you click again, maybe you have to click twice now, you have curriculum and instruction. Because like I said before, kids are not just going to develop these understandings by themselves from just sitting there. You have to have instruction. So you need to develop curriculum materials in order to move kids forward. And in one of the studies, and actually the study that I'm currently doing as well, that's part of what we're doing. So if you move to slide 15, we've been playing around with an assessment item type that I don't know how familiar you are with them. So let's do another little poll. How many of you have heard of ordered multiple choice items? These are multiple choice items that where the distractors, the response options, actually map on to levels of understanding. So how many of you have heard of OMC items? Okay, So we have some folks who have heard about these items. I don't know who came up with them, but I know that Derek Briggs and Elisa Alonso and Wilson and that crew use them quite a bit, and I've had several papers about them. They're neat. So these are multiple choice items. So you have the bonus of a multiple choice item in the sense that they are easy to score. But they give you richer information. So you can kind of, you get more information than just a regular ordered multiple choice, but and they're easy to score. The downside is that they're really hard to develop. And you're always worried that, you know, the kids are not going to understand them the way you mean them to be understood, and that they're not really reflecting how kids would describe their understanding. So you really need to do some intensive validation with these items. We've actually run through like 3 or 4 pilots with our items in order to get a handle on how they're behaving. And you know, some of them are still... We had to drop them just because we couldn't figure out how to fix them. They weren't working quite the way we wanted them to work. So we've been playing quite a bit with these ordered multiple choice items. And, you know, I think they're an interesting direction to take. So moving on to the next slide, slide 16 is an example of one of these OMC items. So this is an item that we use. It's actually from construct B, the construct I just showed you. I already showed you what the right answer is. So that's the blue. Genes have information for assembling amino acids into protein molecules. So what I want you to think for a second is, how do you think a typical high school student would answer this question? And how many kids in high school do you think would get this correct, meaning they would select C? So think about that for a second, and then I'll show you, because if you go to slide 17 and you click once or twice, you get the answer. So about, we did a pilot with about 300 high school kids. These are 11th graders. They were taking biology for the first time in high school, even though they're older. And what you find is about 23% of them get it correct. So this is if you take an OMC item and you score it like an ordinary multiple choice. So it's just C is right, everything else is wrong. If you go to the next slide, there what you see is what happens if you click, you'll get a graph that shows you how kids were actually choosing answers when you start using a partial credit model. And what you see here is that quite a few of the kids are at a level 1 and 2. I know that circle is not quite where it's supposed to be, but it's supposed to be at a level 1 and 2. That's where most of the high school kids are thinking. So if you remember the construct B, response option B here, which is traits, the traits that an individual inherits, which is a level 1, that means they're not really thinking about genes as having information necessarily. So that's a level 2, a level 1. A level 2 is the structure and function of a protein. So these are high school kids that are essentially reasoning at a middle school level according to our progression. And then there's some, like I said, 23% of the kids that are actually reasoning at a level 3. That's the blue font. So that's an example of an OMC item, and it's an example of how we coded it. And we have a bunch of these. I'm not going to show you anymore, but we've sort of been playing around with these items. So you have 300 kids, and you give them a bunch of items, and these items map onto constructs. So the big ideas that I showed you, the 8 big ideas in that table, A, B, C, D, E, we call those constructs. It's language coming from the assessment folk. So imagine that you have about 5 items per level per construct. So if you have 5 constructs and 3 levels per construct, you need a lot of items. That's another place where these OMC items come in handy, because technically each of these items, so the item that I just showed you on slide 18, that item is actually testing three levels, level one, level two, and level three. So with one item, we can hit three levels for construct B. So that also helps reduce the number of items. Otherwise, per construct, if you have three levels, you need at least 15 items, five per level. And then if you have five constructs, it's 15 times five. It's a lot of items, both to design and for kids to take. So OMC items help in that way too. If you go to slide 19, I'm going to do another poll. How many of you have seen these write map thingies before? Write map representations. Yes, no, some no, more no than yes. Ah, equal, okay. So I am not an assessment person. I'm not a statistician. I'm going to explain this at a pretty basic level in terms of what you see. Now, this slide is also animated, so I'm going to walk you through the clicking. So if you click once, you get a rectangle over A items. What's in that rectangle is essentially item difficulties, okay? So the scale here, everything that is on the right is item difficulties. So for item difficulties and thresholds, so these are all the items for construct A. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 items that tested construct A. If you click again, what you see are the kids. So that's the distribution of the kids. Okay, so everything on the left are kids. We'll talk about what this all means in a second once I sort of introduce the bits and pieces of this representation. If you click again, it's timed. So you're going to get the word threshold and three arrows. And what it's pointing to is the top threshold is that blue line. Then the second threshold is the green line, and the last threshold is a red line. What you're actually seeing here is the red line is the threshold for level one understanding. So that's sort of the 50% likelihood that a student will answer at a level one. It's essentially showing you how difficult a level one is, okay? And you can compare it with the green line, which is showing you the difficulty of items that are level two items. And then the blue line is sort of the threshold of moving from level two to level three. So that's sort of the difficulty, the average difficulty of level three items. So first of all, what you want to see is you want the red to be below the green, to be below the blue. And in fact, they are. If your hypotheses about level one, two, and three are wrong, and it turns out that what you think is really hard is not that hard, what you would get is a reversal of these lines. So you might get red, blue, and green, if in fact your level three is easier than your level two. But in this case, for all our constructs, we have red, green, and blue. Level one is easier than level two, which is easier than level three. If you hit again, you get a rectangle that's actually around one item in construct B. And the dots represent sort of the data points of students that are on a level one, a level two, and a level three here. And if you compare, so click again and you'll get to the next slide. Now let's start looking a little bit at patterns. So one thing that you can see in those two red circles is that there's a difference in spread. So for A items, right, the red line is quite far apart from the green and the blue lines, which means that items that are level one items or achieving a level one understanding is fairly easy. In fact, understanding at the level one for construct A is the easiest thing. It is the lowest red line. Getting to a level two is harder. It's a bigger jump, right? You look at the distance between the red line and the green line in that orange circle on item on the A items. And then moving from a level 2 to level 3 is not that big of a jump. So the spread varies. So it's not the case that the jump from level 1 to level 2 to level 3 is always the same. If you can compare it to the F items, which is another construct that we have, there you can see that there's a bigger difference between level 2 and level 3. And actually, level 1 and level 2 are closer together. Okay, so the spread varies across constructs. Also, another thing that you'll notice that varies is where the red lines fall. Right, so for A items, they're the lowest. For C items, they're the highest. So it is really hard to even achieve a level 1 understanding on the C construct. Okay, and the easiest construct here in terms of level 3 understanding, so if you compare the blue lines, the easiest one is construct E. So what this tells you is that it is actually easier to achieve a level 3 understanding on construct E compared to a level 2 understanding on construct B. So if you look where it says B, and you look at there, the green line there is actually higher than the blue line on construct E. So when you run these kinds of analyses, what it tells you about the construct is, well, which one is hard, which one is easy? How easy is it to jump from a level 1 to a level 2 on one construct compared to another construct? Are all these constructs sort of created equal, or are some of them really hard and some of them easier? So before I stop for questions, let's one more slide and go to slide 21. This is an article by Mark Wilson from the 2009 special issue on learning progressions. And one of the points that he raised there, which I think you could see from the right map that I showed you, is that, you know, the levels that of these progressions may not all be the same. So if you look at the first drawing where it's sort of three ladders and they're all side by side, that's assuming that all these constructs are the same, moving along them is the same level of difficulty, okay, and they sort of all happen in parallel. But that may not be the case. It may be that they're staggered, meaning you first really need to understand construct A and get at least a level 2 on construct A before you can get to even a level 1 on another construct. Or it could be even more complicated, like that last drawing at the bottom there, where two things feed into one and then it feeds into another. And so the relationships between these constructs in terms of how kids develop understanding of these big ideas over time is something that requires exploring, and that when we developed the learning progression from the research, there was no way to make hypotheses about how things developed. We assumed initially that everything would just develop in parallel. And what that graphic that I showed you, if you go back to slide 20, is that it's not exactly parallel. Some things are easier, some things are a little harder. They're not lining up exactly the same. On the other hand, it's not the case that one construct is way, way harder than all the others. So that's the kind of information that a right map can give you. And that brings us to slide 22, which is sort of where I want to stop before we get to 22 and see where everybody is. So how are we doing? Do people have questions? I'm seeing things in the chat. Any questions thus far on what I've shown? I'm going to give you an activity in like 2 minutes. We'll have about 15 minutes to do it. Okay. So I'm going to move on a little bit to the next slide or two. There is a paper with my right map data that's coming out in ICLS. So Ginny Choi and I have an ICLS piece that is coming out. I can send you the paper that has a little bit of the white map stuff. Another good article to look at is Ann Rivett, which may be joining us. She's not here yet. I don't know. She might join us later. Ann Rivett has a JARST article. I think it's 2011 or 2012. I'm not sure. She has a bunch of stuff on white maps as well and her constructs using this kind of analysis. I think another person that showed white maps pretty early on was Nancy Songer in the JARST 2009 piece. So let's think, so we kind of got into some nitty gritty and I want to pop up a level because my goal is not really to teach you assessment. Let's think about some challenges. So what we're saying here essentially is that we have a model of how kids' ideas develop over time. Well, one challenge is, well, at what grain size? So how do you define both the grain size of the big ideas and the grain size of the levels? We also have a bunch of assumptions about the learning. So we're assuming that there's sort of some developmental constraints that are shaping how the learning can happen. It's not the case. So the learning progressions research writ large is based on an assumption that there is a finite, in fact, a very small number of paths. Maybe it's more than one, maybe it's two or three, I don't know, but there's some small number of paths from where the kids are to where we want them to be. It's not like a path per child. That's a pretty strong assumption. There are also challenges around observations and interpretation. So when you develop an OMC item, or even if you use an open-ended item, and you're trying to code it according to the levels of the progression, you're a little bit tying yourself down to that theoretical model. So it's sort of, it's a question of how can you figure out what's really out there when you're using statistical methods that are confirmatory. Now, there are some exploratory statistical methods, and Shavelson and Steedle had a wonderful paper in the 2009 issue. I'd highly recommend you read if you're interested in that. Like, how can you tell how many levels are out there? And whether they compared a progression and looked at how kids, they had a bunch of assessment items and looked at how kids are reasoning along the progression according to those items. But they also ran another analysis that was more exploratory to see if you would get the same progression based on analysis on the of those items. So it's a really neat little paper. And then the last challenge has to do with instruction. So if I said that you need instruction to promote learning progressions, how does that quality of instruction actually impact? So let's say we do a study and I develop curriculum material and I give it to children and they learn, but they don't learn as much as I'd hoped, or they learn somewhat differently from what I expected from the progression. Is that a problem with the progression? Is that a problem with the theoretical model that I'm using? Or is that a problem with the instruction? Maybe the design was just not that good. So that's another sort of tricky place that people that are doing learning progressions right now, I think, are sort of thinking about. So I have two options for how to move forward. One option is if you go to slide 23. We can sort of try out categorizing kids' conceptions into a learning progression. So if you go to slide 24, there are a bunch of kid responses to the questions, what do genes do in our body, which is our construct B. And one thing we can do is spend about 5 minutes maybe trying to categorize them and see how many different levels of understanding are you seeing in these responses. And if you see three or four levels of understanding, can you maybe even make an OMC item that captures them? That's a little harder. That's one thing we can do. The second thing we can do is just discuss some of the questions that I have on slide 25, which are sort of general questions that I think the field is dealing with right now in terms of learning progressions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it up to your vote since we're democratic. So if you want to do the coding of the kids' responses, then vote yes now. Not seeing a lot of yeses. If you want to discuss the questions that I have on slide 25, then vote yes now. Okay, so it looks to me like folks want to discuss, which is fine. So let's start with question one, just because I think in my mind at least it's one of the more interesting ones. I'm going to give you some time. Some of you are sitting alone, I think, so just some time to think about this question, and then I'll open it up and I'll stop talking and let you ask questions and talk and tell me what you think about this. So the first question is, can there really be only one or a few paths that we can identify? Is there really one or two best ways of teaching something over time? So take a minute or two, and I'm going to stop broadcasting so other people can jump in, and I'm going to let Frank sort of manage the who gets to jump in first.
Hi, Anne. Sorry to interrupt. You were broadcasting. Welcome to the meeting. So there is currently a question to be reflected upon on slide 25, and we are back into the video discussion in a couple of minutes. And you can find the slides. You can find the slides in the Dropbox, and I put the link into the chat. And there, on slide 25, there is the question number one. I can also copy that question, maybe, so that everyone has it. 1 second. The question is that one.
So I might just jump in with the answer. I would say that there might be an endless number of paths, but I don't think that we can identify all of them. And in the end, there might be a kind of decrease in quality, how good the path is. So maybe there is really only a rather low amount of paths that are really good and maybe could identify as the best path, I would say.
So we've been discussing here that this question probably can't answer it without thinking about how big your like grain size of analysis and understanding of one topic is, because depending on how big or how small you think a topic is, there could be a multitude of ways or not. And especially if you think of a concept that's perhaps not completely correct but might be good for learning, as you've been saying earlier on, and if you think like that, there might be a multitude of paths.
Perhaps I could suggest a distinction we could make here between the assessment portion and the learning progression portion with regard to paths. It seems to me possible that a student could, say, come in at like a level 0, level 1, whatever the lowest steps are on a given learning progression. But just because they're at the lowest level, it doesn't necessarily suggest what the progression to a higher level for that particular student would be, given whatever the prior knowledge of that student might be. We know that students come to school with lots of ideas of their own, and that those ideas can vary across time, space, culture, etc. And so while, you know, student A might be at level 1 and student B might be at level 1, their paths to level 3 or 4, what have you, could be different. However, I do agree with our earlier chime-ins that there might be a fairly limited number of paths that are efficient. There might be some infinite number of potential paths, but the considerations of efficiency probably would dictate that some might be a bit better than others. And yes, to since I can see Ravit's chat question right now before I stop broadcasting, it could be very problematic to try to squeeze all the kids onto the same path. Again, we might need to get into more specifics. I think the devil might be in the details here, but I think same path for all students might not be the way to go.
And if you would like to just jump in and introduce yourself quickly, and maybe if you have a comment on that question as well, you would just have to press the join the queue button that is beneath my video image on the left-hand side, right? Okay.
So hi, everyone. I'm Ann Rivett, a professor of science education here at Teachers College at Columbia University. I've been working with Ravit for a while. And I do work on learning progressions, mostly in the area of earth science and students' reasoning around representations of large-scale phenomena. So how do students develop sophistication and content understanding of large-scale earth systems and the principles that guide those or that are foundational to developing that understanding. So I have just a little bit of my background. So I have my undergraduate degrees in physics, actually, and then I worked at Turk in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right out of undergrad, briefly, and on project-based science curriculum projects. And then I went to the University of Michigan for graduate school, and I worked with Joe Krychek and the Center for Highly Interactive Computing and Education. And that's how I met Ravit, because we were part of the same research center with Northwestern, and developed project-based science units for both physical science and earth science at the middle school level. And I studied the way in which the contextualization of the problems played into how students were reasoning about the science content. I then came to New York and got a position here at Teachers College, where I've been looking at a lot of different aspects of how do you support students in developing understandings of large-scale earth systems, and how do you assess those. So my latest project has looked at ways in which we can develop and use construct modeling as a tool to help us get a grasp on how ideas and reasoning patterns increase in sophistication over time. And in that sense, I have the measurement aspect of the learning progressions piece as one of the key centers of my work. So that's a little bit about me and what I'm doing. About this whole notion of paths, I agree that theoretically there potentially are lots, and I do apologize for being late and missing the first half of the discussion, but I do agree that potentially there are, or at least hypothetically, there are lots and lots of different paths, and each student could get to their own understanding. But even from a knowledge and pieces perspective, the pieces all need to be there in order to develop the kinds of coherent shared conceptual models that allow people, in particular, if you look at this as the kinds of conceptual models that scientists have, they have these shared models so they are able to communicate and have discourse around meaningful ideas. And there are theoretically lots of different ways that you could develop those, but in reality, between the enculturation into the community that shares those common understandings and the nature of the ideas themselves, they tend to, at least in my experience, tend to develop in only a set number of ways. Now, they may happen at different rates, and they may happen around different phenomena, in different contexts. So everybody understands things slightly differently, but at the same time, The actual number of progressions, I don't think is really all that different. I mean, all that diverse. I think we're talking about a very limited scale.
I just wanted to jump in because I think that the argument that there might be many ways, but there are only some ways in real life, only some, well, a few mm-hmm. ways are there, might be already the effect of the instruction within school, because school is like giving one or let's say two or three mm-hmm. paths to the students, and they can't like freely evolve or something, but they are already on these paths. Yeah, we're not studying all in a vacuum. That's right.
Well, and some people have sort of argued. So, for example, Andy Anderson developed the learning progression on carbon cycle. And the way he developed the progression is he interviewed and gave assessments to children of different ages, right? So like early, late elementary, middle schoolers, and so on. And based on what kinds of understanding each age group had, he developed a learning progression. And one of the critiques to that is, well, but you're just mapping out the status quo. You're not, if we actually taught them, development may look different. So it might be that what we're currently using for instruction is not the most effective way. And what you saw was just the outcome of that. But if we could figure out what is the most effective way theoretically, but then we could teach it to them and things might look completely different.
So just building on that, one of the things that we run into, or that I've run into, particularly in more advanced earth science content areas, is that when you look at the disciplines, you have like your geophysicists and your geochemists, and they explain the same phenomena, but they use fundamentally different principles. And when you talk to them in terms of their expertise, they're explaining the same thing, but they're using very different frames to underlie the rationale for their explanation. So we tend to teach one of those, particularly, actually, in our science, we tend to be very, very descriptive and don't get at first principles. But if we were, they tend to present only one perspective on it, whereas in the more interdisciplinary or were those kinds of understandings that sit at the crossroads between different disciplines, that's where I could really see the legitimacy in looking at different pathways to instruction that could potentially lead to different kinds of understandings.
May I jump in? Because I have I had two questions, and maybe you can also postpone answering them, Ravid. But so one question is, what we saw was a learning progression that is really, really domain specific in biology. And I think Anne is talking about earth sciences and physics. And I imagine also learning progressions that are really highly domain specific. My question was, is there also a way to model domain general or say more general skills like scientific reasoning skills, is that out of the scope of this part of your research? And the other aspect, I think it's somehow also related. We're talking about conceptual understanding, and in one of the last webinars we had Jim Greenough with us here, and we were discussing about the relation between conceptual understanding and procedural knowing or being able to do something. So if we talk about skills, can skills also be assessed to some extent with these kinds of learning progressions? So is that also a way to go through these skills three times over the years and have different levels? That would be of interest for me.
Yeah, so I mean, there are actually, there's a learning progressions for models, modeling, practice of modeling in the JARS 2009. Then Kate McNeil and Lima Berlin have, I think it's a 2010 or 11, learning progressions for argumentation. So you can have learning progressions about that are not as domain, I mean, they're about in science, but not specific to an idea. And so I would imagine if you can conceive of, I think that for skills, you could have the same sort of thing. You could have a learning progression that tracks a skill.
Mm-hmm. I would have a quite general question, but I don't know if you want to go on with your slides first, because I'm from math education and I wanted to know if you see real differences between learning trajectories and learning progressions, because there are some like Michael Batista who say that those are different concepts and it's good that they are different, or if you would say, well, it's more or less the same. And yeah.
So I am not that familiar with the learning trajectories in math. One thing that I do know that it seems to be a difference that I've noticed is that in math, the learning progression actually includes instructional strategies. So the way they talk about learning trajectories, it's not just the cognitive model of the develop, but what kinds of problems and strategies you can engage with the students in order to move them. So that in my mind is one big difference. I don't really know if theoretically as a construct they're that different. I think they're both at some level describing development of understanding over time. So in that sense, I think they're the same. But what is included in the box that we call a learning progression, I think varies between the two fields.
There's a question by Andrea in the chat. I'm wondering how one can assess the skills without also inherently assessing the content context of the questions. Maybe Ravid or Anne, you would like to speak to that?
I think you can assess the content without, you can't assess the content without the context. There's always going to be a context. I think you can assess content without skills or without practices, but the context is always there. And some really good work about that is Ross Nim's studies, and Andy DeSessa is actually also someone who, not Andy DeSessa, Andy Anderson is also someone who actually looks at context. So in his learning progression, the phenomena varies. So kids might actually have an easier time reasoning about burning compared to some other process that uses the same principles, like, you know, the cellular respiration. So they have an easier time thinking, I think, about a match burning than cellular respiration. Both of those are essentially the same principles. So they're the same content in a way, but the context really, really matters. And so I don't know we can tease that apart. I think that that is a major question for the field.
For Andrea too, I could suggest the Berland and McNeil 2010 paper that was mentioned earlier. It's a learning progression for argumentation that while it's, I think, you know, clearly intended for science, it somewhat floats free, at least a little bit of the content, because it just focuses on like Toulmin-like argumentation structure. So they want to see if kids are becoming more sophisticated, like are their claims articulated? Are they articulated and defended? Do they evaluate the counterclaim? Things like that. So that would be an example of something that is kind of context-free. But again, you know, you're going to wind up assessing that in some kind of context, whether it's biology, physics, or whatever. Yes, I could. Thanks, Dr. Fisher. I'll put the reference right into the chat in just a second. So if anybody else has any thoughts, I'll turn it over.
I would have a quite general question, because in, you know, specifically in Germany and some parts of Europe, there's a big discussion, and not only a discussion, a development going on in developing competence models, and also Daniel Sommerhoff in math education, he will be involved in the development of some competence models for specific areas in mathematics. Is there a way to relate the work on learning progressions to these competence models? I mean, maybe you're not even familiar too much with these German development. There's a lot of publications also internationally, but maybe they are, at least it seems that they are not so much related. Maybe Daniel, you can tell us a bit more. I was reminded because of the right maps and other things that, and the the IRT and the multiple choice questions that share at least some methodological superficial similarities.
Okay, I'll jump in here. I just copied the citation from Ron. Thank you for that. I guess the parallel between the competence models that are more and more established here in Germany and the learning progressions are that, for example, in mathematics, you say during school there should be like 5 to 6 different competencies built up, for example, modeling or doing mathematical argumentation, using mathematical science or something like that. And on this very decontextualized level, there are different levels of these competencies that students should reach, like level 1, level 2, level 3, and they look quite similar to your learning progressions and the different levels you could within. Are those more practice based? Just thinking about your question. So I think some of them are more higher order skills, but on the other hand, working with mathematical symbolizations and so on wouldn't be that really, really high. But perhaps I would let Frank Fischer jump in here. Argumentation, what we call a practice. Yeah, so there's definitely a practice part in the competence modeling here in the EU. So it's always about they can have the knowledge and the emotional willingness to perform something. So it would be practice.
Yeah, I completely agree with that view on that. It's even sometimes there was a discussion with including Dick Shavelson in recently at a conference on competency models, and Dick Shavelson actually criticized that movement in Germany because they started with going away from just testing knowledge and to go somewhere where it is more about testing the prerequisites for being able to do something in practice, and not only in the practice of science, but in a practice outside of school, in any practice outside of school, basically. But Dick Shavelson criticized that movement for, well, in the end, testing competencies with more or less multiple choice items that are not very close to different practices, because they are so far away from the skills still. If you put your cross at the right point as a multiple choice item or so, it's maybe not, you're not so close to the practices than people originally thought that movement might take us.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So, I mean, Shavelson has also had critiques of learning progressions. The argument that he makes there is that, you know, how are we going to know if we're trying to sort of put a square peg in a round hole? And the concern about, you know, taking this emerging field and reifying it in essentially a set of standards. So, you know, the reason I asked that question with One Path is because in the US, some of these initial learning progressions have been used to inform the development of the framework and the development of the standards. So in some way you can think about it as, well, kids are going to be held accountable to learning particular things at particular levels. It's not that strict yet, but it might be construed as an initial step. And, you know, Shavelson was worried, and rightfully so, that if we're not sure that this is the right path, may we maybe want to hold off from embodying it in policy. I think that the argument for the skills is similar too, because you're assessing something that's a practice using a very different kind of format.
I just wanted to comment on Ron's comment in the chat. He's wondering if performance assessment could be a consideration. And yes, especially in math, it is considered, but it's quite hard to have like non-qualitative performance assessments with large groups of students, also a problem we are fighting here at the LMU, how to assess reasoning. There's nothing there at the moment to do such performance assessments, at least within math, where I know quite a bit about this, that could be done with many students.
Right. I think that, I mean, in science, the same thing, right? You have the practices in the science, the modeling and argumentation, and arguably, how do you assess those? Even tasks in which kids are sort of begin in interview tasks where you're letting kids try and develop a model or work with evidence, those are still very constrained, small problems. You know, you cannot have an interview that lasts 4 weeks. So from a research perspective, it's tricky. It's the same thing from a practical perspective of assessing in classrooms. If inquiry takes time, then assessing inquiry is also going to take time. And how do we go about doing that? So I think that's an open question. There is an NRC report that just came out on assessing, sort of for the new standards, which meld content and practice and also take a developmental progressions approach. I have yet to read it. I'm sure it's really good. I don't know if anyone's read it and can comment. But that's maybe some of the beginning of an answers are in there.
Okay, thank you very much, Ravid. I think we have 5 or 10 minutes left to go. And I wonder, Ravid, how you would like to structure or shape these last couple of minutes. Of course, I think many of us would be interested also in the future of that all. I saw a slide that you prepared for that. And I would also have two additional questions that we ask all of our presenters then in the end.
Right. So I do have a little bit on future research. I mean, like I said before, this is still an emerging field in my mind. I think that we've made some good progress and there's some interesting progressions out there. Still a lot of work to be done. So if anyone's sort of interested in going into the field, this is my handful of questions on slide 26 in terms of what we should be doing next. And one is, I think we need more sophisticated instruments and measurement models. We just talked about measuring practices and skills, and that's not trivial, and I don't think that we're there yet. We need to be sort of stitching learning progressions across grade bands and domains, and that's something that we haven't fully done either. There's some bits and pieces of progress towards that end, but it's really still a very fragmented picture, and it's not clear how, for example, a learning progressions in genetics depends or builds on a learning progression of atomic molecular theory, if at all. We need to better understand how learning and content bootstraps learning of practice and the other way around. So one of the unique features of learning progressions is that they intertwine content and practice. But we don't have a really good handle on, well, how are these things intertwined and how do we develop practice using content and how do we develop content using practice? And what might be a good progression for modeling may work with some content progressions and not work with others. And we don't really know that. And then lastly, implementation challenge. So it's not clear always who the end users of learning progressions should be. There's some folks who think, well, you know, teachers are on some level end users of learning progression. And Aaron Furtak has been doing some really interesting research about that. She's in Colorado. In terms of, well, how do teachers make sense of this? But I think that that's another big open area for research. Figure out, you know, what do we do with these progressions? Is there any way that we need to change them in order for them to be useful for practitioners? So that's pretty much all I had. And I mean, the last point that I want to make on slide 27 is that while They may not be ready for prime time. I believe that, you know, we have a nugget of something good here. It needs a lot of work, but I think that we can make some substantial progress in the field and in education with this notion of learning progressions.
Okay, I jump in here. If there are no immediate reaction to these future challenges, I especially like the challenge number three, the need to better understand how learning of concepts and practices bootstrap each other in different domains. That's, I think, really also in its phrasing, I think it's more or less a research agenda for the next decade, and it tackles or it's addressing the core of research on cognition and instruction as well, I think. Okay, but my questions are the following. First, I think for, this is a series organized by the International Society of the Learning Sciences. And of course, it would be interesting to hear from you, Ravid, how you see the work in learning progressions being related to learning sciences. So why are learning progressions important, a core concept maybe for the learning sciences? This is question one. And question two is, what would be your recommendations for PhD students who would like to somehow work with learning progressions or include some of the ideas on learning progressions in their work?
Right. So in terms of the learning sciences, I think for me the connection is on some level the instructional piece. So if we're saying that learning progressions are sort of facilitated by instruction, a lot of my colleagues who are doing learning progression work have also been doing a lot of design of instructional materials, curriculum, educational software, and so on and so forth. So that's one connection. The other connection is the content. So most of the learning progressions that are out there are specific to some content or practice. And I think that is also reflected in the work of learning scientists. We sort of tend to do research about within specific domains. It's not to say that it's not applicable to other domains, but the role of content matters a lot. We don't necessarily look at cognition as something that's so general and not domain specific. So a lot of the work in progressions is in fact domain specific, involves an instructional design component. And for some of us, at least, it's in beginning to involve classroom research, which is another, in my mind, at least a core aspect of the learning sciences. And it builds on cognitive models and it's essentially testing of cognitive models. So it's really pushing theory forward about how we understand learning as it happens. The second question in terms of learning progressions, I would argue that if you want to get involved in learning progressions, I would get involved with someone who's doing that kind of work or study an existing progression. I don't know that it's particularly productive to go and develop your own. I know sometimes it seems attractive as, oh, I'm really interested in this domain, I'm going to go read up all the literature on it and then come up with a learning progression. It has been done, people have been doing it. I just think that those contributions on some level are, it's not exactly what we need right now. I think that in terms of the field, what we need is to start digging a little deeper rather than having a flurry of learning progressions. They're all kind of different from each other and all over the place, and some are more grounded in research and some are not so grounded in research. I think it would make more sense to start tackling those four questions that I had on those slides. Maybe having two progressions for the same domain, building instruction for both of them, seeing how that pans out, right? Trying to understand the constraints of, is there one path? Is there multiple paths? How do we know when we have a progression that is good? What criteria should we be using? Evidentiary criteria for determining that a progression is good. The question that Frank mentioned that he liked, that the practice and content question is another big one. And people are sort of working on some of these questions, but I think that to make a progress, you really need some sort of of a sort of a threshold effect of enough people working on the question in order to really push the field forward.
Thank you very much, Ravid. So my suggestion would be to have a quick tour de table, final round of reactions, immediate reactions, or at least saying bye-bye. I would like to thank you very much, Ravid. The time is up for this webinar. That was really highly interesting and stimulating for, I think, for the German participants, especially also to see the connection that is not yet established between the competency models and your work. But I really like also the very concrete models that you showed us and the concrete way to approach that. So thank you very much. I think we will hear much more about learning progressions and of your work there in the future. And let's have a quick round through the different sites, and then maybe you have the final words.
So thank you, Ravid, for the very interesting webinar. On the one hand, the competency model where this learning progression discussion was very interesting. I'm definitely also going to look into this new National Research Council a book about the assessment for the next generation. And I think I took quite some few I don't know the English word yet, but I took some things along, and I'm going to see how I can integrate them into my research. So thank you very much from here.
For me too, thank you very much for this very interesting and informative webinar. And also thanks for the short excursion into the white maps. I wasn't familiar with this.
Yeah, from my side also very interesting. Thank you very much, Ravid. And I'm looking forward to listening to the second part where we have introduction to the slides that are left over. Maybe there we could make other appointments for them. Would be very interesting. So thank you. Goodbye.
I want to, along with everyone else, express my gratitude. Thanks, Ravid. I guess the question I'm walking away with is, it seems like it's difficult. I wonder how difficult it's going to be to get authenticity into the validation of learning progressions. It seems like there's some real tension between large-scale deployment and authentic assessments. It'll be interesting to see how that gets hashed out over the years as people continue working on this. And I'm impressed with our European and German colleagues. It's late there, and I'm impressed with your vigor with staying with this.
So there's one other point I wanted to make. It's more organizational, but at the moment we're having an online survey about the webinars, and I'm at the moment posting the link to this survey into the chat, and it would be really nice if you would take 2 to 3 minutes, and it's really not more. I know people tend to say it's 2 to 3 minutes, but it is 2 to 3 minutes, and give us some opinions so that we can suit the webinars even more to your needs. Thank you in advance.
Thanks, Ravid. You've given us a lot of food for thought. You've given us a wonderful overview on just the whole idea of learning progressions and how they're crafted. But you've also left us with a number of questions and a lot of ways that we can tie in what we've been studying as PhD students into what you've presented. So I love the fact that, you know, all of these bits and pieces that I've learned over the years in my studies, I'm seeing them put to action and being used cohesively in these learning progressions.
So I'd like to thank everyone too. I'm glad that it was useful. It was really just sort of a broad brushstroke, and there's a lot of discussion to be had. And I'm sure that if you attend sessions and conferences about them, you're going to get some nice discussion and argument, because it is definitely still a pretty controversial research agenda out there. There are quite a few people that are nervous about how much attention it's been getting politically in the U.S. I don't know what the situation is in Germany in terms of the competencies and whether that's getting any political attention, but this is something definitely to look out for. And yes, we'll be at ICLS. We're going to have LP stuff on there, and it'll be lots of fun. I hope you all can make it, and thank you for being such a wonderful audience.